Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, 40 acres and a mule wasn't just a broken promise. Land was actually given to some formerly enslaved people before it was repossessed by plantation owners. A years-long investigation tracks down who owns that property today. Later in the program, we hear from former Jacksonville FBI agent Ellen Glasser about a new crime documentary based on one of her biggest cases. But first, a new investigation by the Center for Public Integrity, Mother Jones, and Reveal for the first time confirms that the 40 acres notoriously promised to former slaves was actually distributed to hundreds of people only to be later repossessed. It's a story about race and land and reparations, but it's also fundamentally a story about land. Let's hear part of the first episode of the three-part Reveal series.
Owning property has been the American dream far longer than that phrase has existed. It's part of this country's inception. Land was a means for realizing true independence. And this was the promise of 40 acres.
To talk about this story, I'm joined now by April Simpson, racial equity reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome, April.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm also joined by historian Greg Estevez, a Jacksonville resident whose great-great-great-grandfather was initially given 40 acres by the U.S. government, only to have that land revoked. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Thank you so much, Anne, for having me. And hi, April.
Hey, Greg.
April, I'll start with you. This is quite an unusual project. Historically, it was assumed that the 40 acres of that broken promise was only promised, but the government did indeed give land to more than 1,200 newly freed Black people, as your research has helped confirm. Tell us about this project and what it uncovered.
Yes. So we were actually on a different project. And during that research, my colleague stumbled upon these land titles by looking at the Freedmen's Bureau records and was really intrigued by them and realized this was part of 40 Acres and a Mule. You know, this program that I think so many of us have heard of, but don't necessarily understand, you know, the details and the nuances of. So, you know, we, like I think most people, thought this was just a promise, something that was kind of spoken from the field, you could say. But no, there were land titles, there was ink on paper given to the formerly enslaved, and to help them restart their lives. So we spent 2 years reviewing more than a million Freedmen's Bureau records. And as you said, we've been able to so far independently confirm that more than 1,200 formerly enslaved people received one of these possessory land titles. And as far as we know, it's the most detailed accounting to date of how many Black Americans receive land.
And this is an order is based on U.S. Army General William T. Sherman, known as Special Field Orders Number 15. And as you report, this was an effort as the war was coming to a close and the Civil War was ending, to invite the people who were formerly enslaved to weigh in about what it is that they wanted and felt that they needed to move on from this terrible period of slavery. And this was based on the feedback that they received. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, the Union Army is about to take over Savannah, and Sherman meets with a group of ministers, mostly ministers and faith leaders. And, you know, they're asked the question, what do you want? What do you need? And they basically say, we want land and we want to be left alone. And so Sherman says, okay, well, he issues these field orders that say you can receive, or formerly enslaved people will receive land up to 40 acres on 30 miles inland, coastal South Carolina, Georgia to upper Florida. And this would be a place that folks could start their lives, really enjoy freedom. And it was something that got a lot of pushback. It was something that a lot of the former plantation owners couldn't believe, because a lot of this land was made up of hundreds of plantations that was now going to be cut up and given to freed people. The land titles, they came from the Freedmen's Bureau. And like I said, they got a lot of pushback on this program, and ultimately it didn't work out. It was rescinded.
And so, as you say, this land that was granted included all of the sea islands on Georgia and South Carolina's coast. It stretched into northeast Florida, just about to Jacksonville. And in that transfer, some places, including Edisto Island in South Carolina, became a primarily Black island. It was, in fact, a primarily Black island during even slave times, because of the population there that was relatively small of white landowners. But as you say, this didn't last. So President Lincoln was assassinated about a month after these orders were issued?
Yes. So President Lincoln was assassinated. And, you know, the military was prepared to push back. General Howard, Saxton, they were both really pushing for the government to honor this promise to the formerly enslaved. But Andrew Johnson became the nation's new president. He was not committed to this program. He essentially rescinded Sherman's order just 6 months after it went into effect. But there was a lot of push and pull, basically, between D.C. Or the federal government and the military generals and the work that was happening on the ground. So, you know, the generals, they didn't want to see it go, but ultimately Johnson forced their hand. And by the time it was all over, the 40 acres program only lasted about 18 months. But in that time, around 40,000 freed people had settled on hundreds of thousands of acres across Georgia and South Carolina. And, you know, while not all of them had land titles, many believed it was only a matter of time. But instead, the land was returned to the former slaveholders.
And in a little bit, we'll get into where that land is today, what it's being used for today. But I want to bring Greg Estevez into the conversation. Greg, you can trace your ties to this land on Edisto Island for seven generations. Tell us about Jim Hutchinson, who he was, and who he is to you.
Yes. I like to say that, my family can be traced back to Edisto Island, probably to the year of 1683, when they were first forcibly brought here from Africa as enslaved people to work the plantations on South Carolina. So we have very, very deep roots on Edisto Island, South Carolina. And my family was the Hutchinson family. And initially, Jim Hutchinson, who was my great-great-great-grandfather, was a Civil War veteran. As a matter of fact, he fought gallantly in the Civil War. And he also fought with great distinction, or was known for great distinction. And after the Civil War, he became a great leader in the area. As a matter of fact, he was the Republican precinct chairman. And he helped to register African-Americans to vote for the first time and to participate in, you know, the nation's process. But unfortunately, soon after that, he was able to acquire land. We talked about earlier that the land was rescinded because he did have 40 acres. But eventually he purchased 700 acres. And this was money that was pulled together by the African-American community, and they pulled their funds together and purchased two plantations on Edisto Island. And as a result, African-Americans were able to get and receive land for the first time, which the land for them was true independence and also economic empowerment to take care of their families for the first time. Unfortunately, Jim Hutchinson was murdered in broad daylight by a white man from Wadmalaw named Fred Barth. And Fred Barth was eventually acquitted of murder by an all-white jury. And that happened approximately 1885.
So Jim Hutchinson, your great-great-great-grandfather, was born enslaved on Edisto Island.
Yes, ma'am.
And as you say, later played an enormous role in helping Black formerly enslaved people on Edisto Island acquire land. But he initially was deeded this 40 acres as part of this promise of land. He was born enslaved on Edisto. He was owned by a man named Isaac Jenkins Michael.
Correct.
That man was also his father.
Correct.
So he was born of his mother, Maria, who was an enslaved woman who was raped by her enslaver.
Absolutely.
And so that is, you know, speaks a lot about the incredibly difficult history that you have parsed as a descendant of Jim Hutchinson.
Yes, ma'am.
But it is also the story of this land that was split, because the descendants of the plantation owner, Isaac Jenkins Michael, still live there, and they still own land on Edisto Island.
Yes, ma'am, they do.
So explain how that relationship is something that you have explored in your writings and in your work, your history work.
Well, like you said, it's a very difficult and complicated time in our nation. But I would say that it was more than a promise. It was a betrayal, because the land that was granted, or the titles for the land that was given, you know, it was because of, you know, 300 years of free labor. And on top of that, you know, you're talking, excuse me, 300 years of free labor. And then on top of that, the service that they provided in the Civil War, because a lot of them were veterans and they fought gallantly. So they had earned the right for some type of reparations. So, like I said, it was a betrayal. So I would say, you know, when you're talking about, you know, Article 15 and the fact that it was rescinded, that it created, you know, generational wealth that became a problem for generations, even to this day.
So the plantation owner, Mikhail, was unbelievably wealthy, according to records that this reporting has found. There were about 350 enslaved people on Edisto Island that got a land title from the Freedmen's Bureau. That land later rescinded, as you say. The descendants of Mikhail, though, continued to own that land. April, I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, teasing out the different outcomes for these families that are intertwined, both in terms of the land and in terms of their genetic heritage that they share, and yet very different outcomes.
Yes, yes, different outcomes for sure. So, you know, as you said, Isaac Jenkins Michael, he was a very wealthy plantation owner, and was basically able to leave his land to descendants who are still on it today. And in the podcast and show, we interview two of those descendants, or three actually, but two on Peters Point Plantation who are brothers and, you know, still live on, 250 acres, I think, between them. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's on a creek. It's gorgeous. It's lush. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. Jim Hutchinson's descendants, like Greg, were also able to acquire land because Jim Hutchinson was so persistent and determined, even after losing his 40 acres. So, you know, those descendants still have a hold of some of the land that Jim Hutchinson acquired as well. Jim Hutchinson's portion of that 700 acres that Greg mentioned was about 230 acres. And over the time, you know, some property was never willed to anyone. It's still sitting in heirs' property, which is kind of a legal, it's a form of ownership that is very tenuous. But there's about 6 acres that is still solidly within the family today. And, you know, everyone is very, and obviously Greg can speak to this, but folks are very proud of being able to hold onto this land from Jim. And as I said, Jim Hutchinson's descendants have done very well for themselves. Emily Meggett, Greg's cousin, who passed last year, was a very famous Gullah Geechee cook, had a New York Times bestselling book. And there are many others like Greg who have been successful.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the broken promise of 40 acres and a mule and the descendants living with that decision. You can join the conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We have a call from Cornell in downtown. Good morning, Cornell. Go ahead.
Hey, hello. How are you doing? I have two specific questions, one for the reporter and also to the descendant of Mr. Jim Hudson. My first question is to the reporter. Do you plan on going further in more in-depth research about this issue of the 48th of Mr. Jim Hutchinson? How does it make you feel knowing that you have something that was promised and you still hold on to it? Those are my two questions.
Thanks, Cornell. Let's start with you, April.
I think the question was whether we plan to do additional reporting.
Correct.
On this. We hope to. We've made a lot of information public. So there is actually a database that anybody can go to and search Freedmen's Bureau records, 1.8 million Freedmen's Bureau records. And you can search by names, places, and keywords. There's also image recognition technology that allows you to search documents that have not yet been transcribed. So our hope is that folks will go to this database and, you know, also do their own research. We hope that people feel empowered to do the work that descendants like Greg have done and learn about their history as well, because we know how powerful that is. We have two stories expected to publish this week, tomorrow, Tuesday. So that's some additional reporting. And then we've shared this information with news partners throughout the country. So we're hoping to see other news outlets do similar stories in their communities.
And I should ask you, while we're on the subject of doing those searches, where people can find that database?
So if you go to motherjones.com and search for 40 acres, or 40 acres and a lie, which is the name of the project, you'll be led to a landing page that includes a link to that database on it.
And we should say the Mother Jones story is, we linked to that on our website at First Coast Connect. Greg Estevez, I believe Cornell wanted you to answer the question of, you know, what this experience is like for you, knowing what's been taken.
Well, I would have to say, you know, as a nation, I think that we still grapple with a very ugly past, you know, and it still has an impact and effect on many Americans, both, you know, of different races and ethnicities. It even goes to how we relate to each other, how we see each other, and how we get along. So I think that this is something that has to be addressed. And one of the things that I would have to say would be reparations. Now, I want to say, you know, reparations, for most people, when they hear that, they thinking that it involves money, but not necessarily, because when you're talking about reparations, you're talking about fixing or repairing something that has been broken or damaged that has never been addressed. So how can you do that? There's several ways. Education, it could be, you know, through economics, it could be through money, you know, other situations as far as that's concerned. But I think this is a situation in this country that needs to be discussed in a more tangible and definite way.
April, I'm going to have you set up some sound, because you and reporter Nadia Hamden spoke to the descendants of the Michael plantation owner, who are still alive today and still live on some of that land in Edisto Island, as we mentioned. You spoke to one of the descendants. His name is Pinckney Michael, and he expressed some real concerns about tackling such a difficult subject. He said that he was scared to talk about it. He says, "I'm clearly a white guy who's benefited tremendously by privilege and the Civil War, but his brother Jenks Michael had a different view. Can you set up this conversation we're going to hear a little bit of?
Yes. So Pinckney and Jenks are very interesting people because they're about 10 years apart in age. They're both baby boomers, and they have very different political leanings. Pinckney is, he calls himself a cranky liberal. Jenks is conservative, and Pinckney does believe in some form of reparations, not for slavery, but kind of for more, for Jim Crow and for more recent discrimination. Jenks, however, is very much opposed to reparations. He feels like the government is giving too many things away, and he is quite pained by the way the as he called it, the situation the country is in right now.
So let's hear some of that. This is the brother Jenks Michael talking in this Reveal podcast.
Do you feel like descendants of the formerly enslaved who have worked land on these plantations on Edisto Island are warranted some kind of payment or reparations for the time they spent enslaved?
No.
No?
No.
Why is that?
Anybody in this country who wants to do better has the opportunity to do it. There are many, many, many black folks around this country that have been very, very successful. Now, you explain to me why.
I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand how...
It's all up in them.
Hundreds of...
If we keep giving away stuff, that's all we're going to be able to do is give away, because people don't want to work, because they don't have to work, because all we're doing is giving them freebies. Nobody ever gave me anything other than this, but I now had to sweat bullets to keep it.
I respect that. I just, you know, there's no denying that hard work has gone into your life, Pinckney's life, Carol's life, everyone's life, but I think even you just said, I haven't been given anything, but I was given this. And so is it not fair to at least acknowledge that there has been some privilege in having hold of this land?
Did they not have land?
They meaning black people.
Yeah, they had it.
And then it was taken away.
I don't know whether it was taken away or not. Some of it was given back, but not all of it.
So April, there's an interesting moment there where he says, you know, I wasn't given anything except this, meaning the land, which really is sort of what's at issue. Is that fair?
That's how he feels. He feels that he, you know, like he said, he wasn't given anything except for this plantation land. He holds about 70 acres of Peters Point Plantation. And he talked to us, I guess, not in the podcast, but he did speak also about how difficult it has been to hold on to the land and to keep up with the taxes over the years. And, you know, this the struggle that it's been to keep it now. He also sees himself as a caretaker of the land, less someone who is holding it at this time.
I should be clear, when I say to be fair, I just meant, is that a fair assessment of his view? Not necessarily was that a fair perspective for him to have, but.
Okay, yes, yes it is.
I want to take a couple of calls. We've got Eugene on the north side. Good morning, Eugene, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, all the staff and management. Very interesting topic. We have a real, we're at the crossroads of a real issue, and it needs to be addressed from the White House to my house. The unfortunate thing is we use slavery, the term slavery, it's got different definitions now. We call apprenticeships free work. We give people apprenticeships, and we bring them out of college, and we give them, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but we
like an internship
on these programs,
like an internship,
free labor.
Gotcha.
Football, basketball, baseball. You have all these young people coming from impoverished situations, and I'll call out a couple of names: Devlo Sweeney, and the gentleman just stepped down from University of Alabama. These guys are making gazillions of dollars, and they're opposed to the guys or the young men to get revenue just to support the family to bring them out of poverty. Mm-hmm. Free work, free slavery, and we're still doing it all over America, and we just call it a different name.
Thank
it's
you.
The same thing.
Thanks, Eugene. Appreciate your thoughts. I want to take a call from Will on the South Side. Good morning, Will. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ann. This is Wells.
Oh, Wells. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Wells Todd with Take 'em Down Jacks. I want to say this is a very important program, and this history is the type of history that our governor does not want to be taught in our schools. I want to announce to your guests and everybody listening that we are putting on a program July 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Jesse, which is 40 East Adams Street. It's recasting the past from Confederate monuments to symbols of peace, featuring Dr. Andrea Douglas. Dr. Andrea Douglas is an executive director of the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. They have gotten a hold of the Robert E. Lee statue that was taken down, and it's been melted down into ingots. And she'll be speaking July 12th. It's free, and we invite everybody to attend that. One last thing. One of the things that Frederick Douglass said after President Lincoln was assassinated, they went to visit President Johnson at the White House. And when they left that meeting, Frederick Douglass said he is no friend of the Negro. Johnson invited Southern enslavers to the White House at a time when Congress and whatnot was not in session, and had them apologize for the war and gave them back their land and pushed freed Africans off the land. So I just wanted to add that. I want to thank you for your time and for this show.
Thanks, Wells. Appreciate your comments. We also have a call from Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I said that's a great point.
Yeah. I want to take a call from Tom in Jacksonville. Good morning, Tom. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. You had introduced the show the beginning as if this was a new discovery, as if, look, I just found this item in the history books. Quite frankly, it's nothing new. I learned about this in my history class in 1966. So this is nothing ordinary. I mean, it was extraordinary then, and it's extraordinary now, but it's nothing new. This is not a new discovery. It's been kicking around for a very, very long time. So this is not something great. This is not something brand new. It's a known fact for a long time. And that's my point.
Thanks, Tom. April, I'll have you respond to that.
Yes, Tom, thank you. I just wanted to add that a couple things that are new, the ability to be able to search 1.8 million Freedmen's Bureau records that we've provided. That's something that we weren't able to really do before. The ability to know that there were more than 1,200 formerly enslaved people who received one of these possessory land titles. As I said before, it's the most detailed accounting to date of how many Black Americans receive land. And then the ability to use these resources to more quickly and efficiently conduct genealogical research. So I hope that is, something people will be able to utilize and feel good about.
But to his point, I mean, the story presents an argument that this is verifying what had long been thought to be merely a promise that wasn't delivered upon, and that this is verifying that it actually was delivered upon. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. The land titles, we talked to historians and experts who had never actually seen them themselves. It's also just dispelling a lot of the myths around 40 acres, which I think has been a guiding force for a lot of, especially reparations advocates, but we don't truly understand the nuances of the program.
So I do want to talk about what is on the land today. And I'll start with you, Greg, if you can describe to us some of the property that we're talking about. The podcast does go and talk to residents of these places, but they obviously, like a lot of sea islands and a lot of coastal, the United States, it's a fairly developed and fairly wealthy group of homes and residents.
Well, yes. Edisto Island, one of the things that they do have in the African-American community that is still there is the Hutchison House. And we're very proud of that. The Hutchison House was built in 1885, and that was barely 20 years out of the institution of slavery. And it was built by my family members, which was my great-great-grandfather, and he built it for his wife at the time as a wedding gift, his wife Rosa, which was my great-great-grandmother. But the Hutchison House has become a symbol of resilience. It's become a symbol of economic empowerment, and it shows the true independence of the newly freed enslaved people at that time. Right now, it's currently being restored. And I want to say this is the oldest, or one of the oldest freedmen homes that is being restored in the state of South Carolina. So we are very proud of that heritage, which my family is a part of.
And that's an exceptional piece of history that's saved and exists because there was Black land ownership there, despite the rescinding of the 40 acres rule. But April, describe for us what most of that other land looks like today.
Well, you have some folks who are still on the land, like the Michaels, and then you have other places where this has been developed into it's prime real estate. So one of my colleagues, she reported in Georgia on a place called The Landings that was former plantation land that was a part of the 40 acres program and is now a very wealthy subdevelopment where some of these lots sell for, like millions of dollars. This place has several golf courses, and it's a beautiful place to be.
Yeah. And so the subject of, you know, what that means in terms of being able to trace some of those properties back to this program, does it mean anything in terms of the question of reparations or trying to make good in any way on that broken promise?
I think some people would argue that it does mean something in terms of transfers of intergenerational wealth. So if the formerly enslaved were able to hold on to that land and then transfer it to its descendants, you know, we just don't know what they could have done with it, how they could have benefited from it. But it certainly would have been more money in their pocketbooks if they could have held on to it even today, as the Michaels have. So there is, as we're able to connect the folks who had the land back then to some of what that land is today and who's on it, there is wealth that was lost along the way.
Well, April Simpson, equity reporter, racial equity reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, Greg Estevez, historian and Jacksonville resident, thank you both so much for coming on today and talking about this project.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk to the lead FBI agent behind a top 10 Netflix documentary with two remarkable Atlantic Beach connections. Welcome back. A new crime documentary with local ties has become a top 10 hit on Netflix. It's called How to Rob a Bank. And here to tell us about it is Ellen Glasser, former Atlantic Beach mayor and retired FBI agent, who is also known on the program as Agent Mom.
Yes. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Nice to have you. So The story focuses on a serial bank robber from the 1990s?
Right. It was he robbed banks between 1992 and 1996 when his end of days came.
Okay. And you had a little something to do with that. His name was Scott Scurlock, but he went by a different name in your circles.
Right. We nicknamed him Hollywood because he wore theatrical makeup into the banks. It turned out to be a perfect nickname for him, given what we found out later in his love of the movie Point Break. And he modeled himself after the character Bodie that Patrick Swayze played.
Remind us, not everybody's seen Point Break, although it's become a bit of a cult classic. But in that film, they robbed banks and wore masks.
That's right. That's yeah. right. And it was a movie in the 90s. It's a great movie, but Hollywood watched it with his accomplices and other bank robbery movies, too.
And so was he wearing Nixon masks or Reagan masks?
Presidential masks.
Presidential
yes.
masks. All right. So he had these elaborate disguises, but he was seriously a threat in terms of being a perennial bank robber. This was in Seattle.
He robbed banks also in Portland, but most of them were in particular areas in Seattle, and it was a threat. It was something that really rocked the neighborhoods that he robbed in.
So how did you get involved in the case?
Well, it's a fascinating story. He had robbed many banks, and then in 1996, I became the supervisor of this joint task force. And this was one of the major cases where Seattle police had been responding to banks. And we were working major cases, too. And so we joined forces to try to be greater than the individual parts of the story to try to apprehend him. So as the supervisor, I came in and brought resources. We got banks involved. We did training on felony car stops. We got equipment. We did a lot of things to come together on this. And that is ultimately what brought this bank robber down.
And so what is it that gets the FBI involved when there's something like a series of banks being robbed in a certain area? Is that an automatic or is that only if it continues?
Well, it used to be automatic. We would go to every bank robbery, and most bank robbers are stupid. They really just are. But Hollywood was at a different level. And because he had robbed so many banks, we had a strategy to try to lure him, and we really did set a trap for him at the final bank that he robbed.
What was the strategy? You were sort of mapping out locations or tracking his rhythm of when he would rob banks?
We did. And so the detective and the FBI agent, they have a very fascinating interplay in the Netflix documentary. They didn't really get along, but one of the detectives really worked the streets. He knew the streets like the back of his hand. He was out there waiting for Hollywood to hit. But the other FBI agent who worked with him was really calculating how much time took place between robberies and where they took place. And he came up with a hunch on when he might hit again. So we got the banks together to help us install tracking devices in most of the banks in that area. So it took a huge amount of coordination to get those tracking devices, which were not a thing back in the 90s.
Right.
And then to get the police department trained up on tracking these devices. So it was a huge effort, and I'm really proud to have been part of leading that.
But it was a very dangerous, in the end, it became a very dangerous takedown. Explain to us what happened, because you were right in the center of that.
Right, right. Well, I was very involved in training, and we had hundreds of people involved in this case, although in the documentary, you really focus on three of the good guys, and I'm one of those guys. We would install these tracking devices in the vault money because Hollywood wanted more money, so he would always do these vault takeovers. His activities were escalating, and we lured him in by talking about him in the media. And as it turned out, he was a very cocky guy, and if you watch the documentary, you'll see what I'm talking about. But he wanted to get that big haul. And so we worked together it happened the night before Thanksgiving in 1996.
And there was some gunfire involved. So tell us about that.
Well, it was interesting. With all the preparation that I had done as the supervisor, I was the only FBI agent out there that night because I was in the office late. We ended up in a hail of gunfire, and I was being shot at point-blank range, and I was in a crossfire between Hollywood and the van that his team was in and the police behind me. And ultimately, Hollywood escaped that night, but he committed suicide the next day as part of a much bigger operation. And then two of the bank robberies were injured. They were prosecuted, and they went to jail for more than 20 years for trying to kill me.
Wow. And that must have been an incredibly traumatic experience.
Well, it was traumatic, but if you'll see in the documentary, I was always concerned that somebody was going to get hurt and that this was going to escalate. It played out really the way that I thought that it would, except that I really didn't expect to be in the middle of the gunfire. But it presents trauma to lots of people, tellers, bystanders, and to the team that worked it. I mean, it was a long time before I really would even talk about the case.
You were called Agent Mom in the film because you were a mom at the time. I mean, right. That must have changed in some ways how all of that felt.
Oh, it did. In fact, my youngest child, Harry, is about the age that he was born in that year of Hollywood. And he's a firefighter with JFRD now. And, you know, I just think about what would have happened if I hadn't been around to be with my kids. I mean, I was very aware of the fact that I had two lives and I had this sort of badass FBI side and I had this nurturing side of being a mom with babies at home. In fact, we were supposed to have pizza that night and we were supposed to have Thanksgiving dinner the next day and my kids had to spend Thanksgiving with the neighbors.
Wow. And it's interesting how you were located by the producer for this film in Atlantic Beach. He had a connection there as well.
That was such a random thing because I always knew this was a great story, but I just never really thought it would be told. And now, 28 years later, I'm happy to talk about the case. I've learned more about it from watching the documentary because there are new things. But one of the directors, Seth Porges, his parents lived in Atlantic Beach. So when he started looking at the story and was talking to people, they said, well, who knows this story? And they said, well, Ellen Glasser, and she lives in a place called Atlantic Beach. And so at that point, we were all hooked. I was happy to cooperate with him. And he's an award-winning journalist, and he did a great job. And of course, when you get Netflix involved, it goes to a whole nother level.
And so he called you and said, I'm kind of a constituent. Is that how he reached out?
I don't know that I remember those words precisely, but it tracks pretty closely.
So you worked on a lot of memorable investigations and cases. You were involved with a terrorism task force here after 9/11.
Right.
You were involved with Iran-Contra. Where does Hollywood rank in the grand scheme of all the things that you did as an FBI agent?
Well, it's my only shootout, so it's different in that respect. And I think about it quite a lot, but I worked public corruption cases and other very big bank robbery cases and extortion cases. I'm going to say it's probably number two.
Yeah. Is it fun to see it now on the big screen?
It really is. And again, I mean, it was years before I could really talk about it because we couldn't talk about the tracking devices. We didn't want to divulge the kind of techniques that we used. And I don't want to glamorize or glorify bank robbers.
Sure.
Because, you know, he did get away with them for a while. But really, I think that it's a great story. And he was such a charismatic character that I just think that it's really interesting to watch it, and I hope other people will too.
Well, it's in the top 10 on Netflix, so you can watch it now. Ellen Glasser, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And up next, we talk about the latest in automotive headlines with our resident gearhead, Dan Scanlon.
Next time on The World, a musician born in Mumbai, India, brings her own spin on classic American folk tunes.
I don't see any difference between when I sing Wayfaring Stranger or a Bilawal Raga from India.
Her band, the American Patchwork Quartet, is taking the stage at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. Catch that story on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9. On the next Fresh Air, comic and actor Hannah Einbinder. She's co-starred in the hit show Hacks for 3 seasons, playing a young writer in a love-hate relationship with her boss, a veteran comedian played by Jean Smart. Einbinder also has a new special on Max called Everything Must Go. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Far-right parties made gains across Europe in this month's European parliamentary elections. What's driving the shift?
European voters show that they're more concerned about what's directly impacting them. And we can really draw a line from the rise of right-wing politics with the rise in the number of immigrants that have been coming into Europe over the years.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Inflation is dropping, but high interest rates still have a lot of us feeling the squeeze on our wallets. Next time on 1A, we look at how the state of the economy might influence the vote in November. We'll also unpack Project 2025, the plan for a Christian nationalist government if Donald Trump is reelected. What issues will matter most at the polls? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. From cars with open bars to insurance rates that are rising with the floodwaters, we are here with our resident gearhead, Dan Scanlon of WJCT News, to talk about the latest automotive headlines. Hey, Dan.
Hey there. I'll have a pizza of the action for you soon.
Oh, I cannot wait for a pizza of the action. Thank you. But let's start. There's a sort of semi-secret, anonymous, autonomous vehicle maker that has got its eyes on the First Coast.
Well, the city council did approve, I think about a week ago, $7.7 million in incentives for a plant, an autonomous vehicle plant, as yet unnamed, that would be opened in the city by 2025. Jacksonville Daily Record indicates hints that that could probably be Holon. And in fact, a Holon people mover was on display at the recent JTA.
What's Holon?
Autonomous. It's basically a maker of a box-shaped multi-passenger people mover that's autonomous, electric-powered. And, of course, we in Jacksonville are a year away from seeing the Bay Street Innovation Corridor, which would, at the initial point, be using autonomous Ford vans with an observer from JTA inside to take you up and down Bay Street and around this area that we exist here. And then, ultimately, I would believe you would see these boxy people movers take over for those. And
so
then
it could
those,
be convenient if they
it
were
could
being
be
made
convenient
here.
If they're being made locally. We've had this before. We actually had a van company that wanted to move here, and the city threw lots of incentives at it. And this is about 10 years ago, and it never happened. And then the whole thing never happened. It was a Freightliner Mercedes deal. So
and
we've been down this road before.
I mean, indicates that there might be a connection here. It's not just pure speculation, right? They've got a Project Link, which lists Jacksonville as a partner on its website. So there is some tissue there to that connection.
Right. And JTA has a center on the west side, northwest side, where they're testing autonomous vehicles. And they've certainly shown everybody from Beep on up of autonomous vehicles for us to ride in and learn more about. So it's anybody's game, but initially they want to use a vehicle that's got a steering wheel, and that's what we're going to see on the Bay Street corridor. And then obviously as that extends to up on the Skyway Express, my guess is that they would not use those vans, that they would go to a people mover, which fits more with the overhead tracks and then going across the river into
San
Marco.
And it's actually autonomous.
That's actually autonomous and fits the concrete slot.
So there'd be some jobs with this if it came. Is that true?
Well, obviously, we've got a number of jobs as the JTA is building its Innovation Tech Center and Control Center right now. They just had the groundbreaking a week or so ago.
But if Holon comes?
Oh, yeah, because you have to build these things, and it wouldn't be just for Jacksonville. They're taking hold. Inner cities are going to be using these things, whether or not we like autonomous boxes going by us or driving among us. And there's other issues with autonomous vehicles,
well,
obviously.
Let's talk about that, because there were some that were recalled recently. Is that right?
Well, the situation is that Waymo has had some issues. They actually had one of their vehicles in Phoenix, according to news sources, hit a telephone pole. I guess its computer didn't see a telephone pole as an obstacle. NHTSA, highway transportation folks, have actually had 22 recalls for Waymo vehicles, and those are modified Jaguar I-Pace electric vehicles. So they are production vehicles. So whatever issues are there, the software, the computers, the sensors, whatever, Plus, there's the old saw that people are finding they can actually stop these things in their tracks by putting an orange traffic cone on the hood, which totally confuses an autonomous vehicle sensors.
But there's some interest by our own chamber even in some of these vehicles.
There was a suggestion that Waymo be involved in the future here in Jacksonville, but...
Who suggested that?
I don't know that because the brain's not functioning right now, but... autonomous yet.
I'm sorry. I thought that we talked about there was like a chamber official on a trip to Phoenix who was maybe interested in bringing some of
the president
of
the chamber had said the city should look into partnering with Waymo. That's a suggestion from the business side. But if you've got your secret, top secret $7.7 million incentive, then it looks like, hold on, if what we're hearing from the Daily Record is true, would be the local, because there's a possibility here, and what added incentive would you have? Hey, you build it here, we'll use you.
I gotcha. So I got to talk about this because it's just interesting. Lexus has rolled out a new vehicle that they're describing as a culinary experience on wheels. They rolled it out at the Aspen Food and Wine Festival. What's in here?
Well, first of all, it's a luxurious interior in their GX, which is their top-end vehicle. There is a spherical ice cube maker, because we all know that high-end cocktails need a big round ball of ice in them.
Sure.
But in back is a 30-inch smart flush hearth pizza oven, so that you can bake your pizza while you're out camping. You can make your cocktails, and then you can recline in your custom leather seats with air conditioning and stereo system and enjoy said meal and libation.
This is designed for camping, for glamping?
It's designed for glamping. It's a concept vehicle only. It's just for show. It got a lot of social media coverage this weekend because it really is nothing more than just the big Toyota SUV, but glamorized by Lexus and then further glamorized with these special goodies. Yeah.
And you get to test drive cars sometimes. Are you going to get to test drive this one?
Not unless I get invited someplace fun, and that doesn't happen much anymore. Budgets are tight.
Well, if you do, please invite us over for a slice.
I'll make it myself.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Dan, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate these monthly visits to talk about all things automotive.
Sure.
All right. That's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed anything, you can check out our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, or you can subscribe to our podcast. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett. Our associate producer is Jamie Vallée, and our theme music is performed by Club de Belugas, directed by Brady Corum on the board right now. Join us tomorrow when government attorney Chris Hand examines the slate of freshly qualified candidates for state and local races. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.